Open the meeting with, my name's Judy and I'm an addict.
Hey,
hi, can we please open the meeting with serenity prayer? God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okay, can we have, as you do the reading, come up here so that you can be recorded. Read the press statement.
I'm an addict named Emma.
Emma.
Okay, press media announcement. Statement to members regarding the press. As our 11th tradition says, our public relation policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. The primary purpose of our public relations efforts is to tell the story of Narcotics Anonymous and what our program offers to the still suffering addict. Members of the press are sometimes attracted to our convention, and we welcome their interest. However, we do not disclose our last names in the media as identifiable members of Narcotics Anonymous. If a member of the press approaches you, please direct them to the chair or the vice chair of the convention. Statement to the media. If any members of the media are present, we ask you to contact the chair or the vice chair of the convention for information.
Thank you.
Thanks, Judy.
We have the social media statement.
I'm an addict. My name's Bodie.
Hey, Bodie.
Social media statement. The widespread use of social media networking and social media by our fellowship indicates that these forums are resources that can serve to facilitate greater communication and interaction among Narcotics Anonymous members. With that being said, some of our members may not want to be depicted in photos on social media platforms. Please be mindful of this and get permission from members if you intend to post their photos on any type of social media.
Thank you. Can we have clarity of statement, please?
I'm Jeff and I'm an addict.
Hi,
Jeff. Clarity statement. At any meetings, we introduce ourselves as addicts. When members introduce themselves as addicts and alcoholics or talk about living clean and sober, the clarity of the NA message is blurred. To speak in this manner suggests that there are two diseases, that somehow one drug is separate from the rest, requiring special recognition. Our identification as addicts is all-inclusive in reference to the disease of addiction. It allows us to focus on our similarities and not our differences.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for reading.
Can we have the reading of who is an addict?
I'm Steve, I'm an addict.
Hi, Steve.
Who is an addict? Most of us do not have to think twice about this question. We know. Our whole life and thinking was centered in drugs in one form or another. The getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. We live to use and use to live. Very simply, an addict is a man or woman whose life is controlled by drugs. We are people in the grip of a continuing and progressive illness whose ends are always the same. Jails, institutions, and death.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And can we have, why are we here?
I'm an addict named Bobby.
Hi, Bobby.
Hi, everybody. Why are we here? Before coming to the fellowship of NA, we could not manage our own lives. We could not live and enjoy life as other people do. We had to have something different, and we thought we had found it in drugs. We placed their use ahead of the welfare of our families, our wives, husbands, and our children. We had to have drugs at all costs. We did many people great harm, but most of all, we harmed ourselves. Through our inability to accept personal responsibilities, we were actually creating our own problems. We seemed to be incapable of facing life on its own terms. Most of us realized that in our addiction, we were slowly committing suicide, but addiction is such a cunning enemy of life that we had lost the power to do anything about it. Many of us ended up in jail or sought help through medicine, religion, and psychiatry. None of these methods was sufficient for us. Our disease always resurfaced or continued to progress until, in desperation, we sought help from each other in Narcotics Anonymous. After coming to NA, we realized we were sick people. We suffered from a disease from which there is no known cure. It can, however, be arrested at some point, and recovery is then possible.
Thank you.
Thanks for
okay, so it's time now to introduce our first speaker. The gentleman that was asked to share at the meeting today, his name is Alan, and he's from Virginia. And I'll let him tell you his own story.
All right. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
What are you doing?
I'm Alan. I'm an addict.
Amen.
You know, there's a couple of things I want to mention here. First, you know, it's really cool to be back in Pittsburgh. My first East Coast convention was here in 2012, the first one I ever went to. And that's where I got introduced to this convention. And then I think you guys hosted it back in 2016. Yeah, my mother was dying at the time, so I had to miss that one. But so it's really cool to be here because this is a real solid NA community. You know, I know some people here personally, and it feels real good to be here. And something else, too, I just wanted to mention. I've been really excited about this. Like, I love Narcotics Anonymous, but, like, this convention in particular, I just want to sit from... I'd like to just say thank you to anyone that's ever been involved with this, the advisory board, the host committees, or in everyone here, because I'll tell you why. Like, here just a couple weeks ago, I received a box of books from last year's convention. And, like, I was just so excited when I got it. It was like, can we send the books to you for you to take to your area of service? And why I say that is, just to give you an idea, I'm from the Blue Ridge area of Narcotics Anonymous in the Shenandoah Valley, Virginia. We have about 20 weekly meetings, and there's about 8 home groups putting on those 20 meetings, to give you an idea. But don't get me wrong, the message is strong there. It's just, and so what I'm saying is, you know, like, this convention, the theme is Be the We. It's a huge thing, the support we got. This just box of books, like with our H&I efforts, that, like, it frees up resources for us to do other things. We can take care of these facilities with these books, but it gives us resources to even help us more with carrying the message. So we really appreciate it. Like, I mean, like, I was sharing about this for like a week at the meetings, and people got kind of tired of hearing me share about that, you know. But it's a big deal to me. But you know, the topic, the gift of desperation, for me, you know, when I think about that, like, I think that desperation is a common thread here, you know, the driving force, and everyone's level of desperation or how it looks is different, I guess. You know, for me, I guess when I say that, you know, my using it had progressed. You know, I started using young. It progressed all the stuff that happens there. But, like, you know, I'd gotten to that place, you know, that hopeless spot, that feeling of impending doom. You know, I knew the other shoe was going to drop, you know, just always that feeling. But you know, when I think about that desperation, for one of the times I can remember anyway distinctly, it was one of the last times I was using, and I was getting things together to use, and I remember just, like, saying to myself, do we really got to do this again? I mean, I was using against my will. I knew I was, but that was the first time that I remember that it was really apparent. Because, see, up until then, I was always one of those ones, like, I knew it was a problem, but, like, I'm going to pull this thing together tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to be the day I pull it together, you know. But tomorrow never came around, you know, for me. And so, you know, for me, I needed, I guess, something greater than myself. You know, I had that desperation, but, like, so I was there, you know, using. I was in this old truck of mine, this place up in the woods, using alone, you know, just wishing I could stop. And then it was, I don't remember, it was either the next day or 2 days later, I got arrested. And that was, like, my moment of clarity, you know, the desperation. It was almost like I was, like, watching this from above. I was laying across a police car in cuffs, and I turned around, looked at the one cop, and said, I'm done. And I didn't even really know what that meant, because, like, I'd never been introduced to Narcotics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about recovery. The only thing I knew about recovery before I got here was we used to have this place, they called it the Lodge. And, like, I knew several guys, whenever you got, like, jammed up with your wife or your job was on the line, they'd go to the Lodge for, like, a month. They'd come back, talk different for a little bit, and then they'd use again. That's what I knew of recovery. That's how powerful this program is, you think about it. It's cool. We've got our own language here. You know, we've got our own message, and it's strong. You know, so I remember, like, when I was at the police station, and I felt a sense of relief, too. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I felt like finally something outside of myself was going to make me stop, because I couldn't do it on my own. And I didn't really know what that looked like. And so, you know, they had me, and I'll say this too, I was lucky. They got me on the small charge and not the big charge, you know. And so I felt like this was like my one chance if I wanted to do something. And there's a line here I got in my pocket. I don't want to mess it up here. In this IP, another look, I like this, you know. This is what, you know, this spoke to me. Like, you know, see, I got I went to my probation officer at the time. I said, man, I want some help. But I couldn't figure out if I really wanted help or if I was just trying to slip my neck from the noose again. You know, that's what I, you know, had always done and been pretty lucky at it. But, you know, this, I like this IP. And it talks, there's a thing in here that talks about addiction is not freedom. But it says, you know, even in periods of abstinence, freedom is curtailed. We're never quite sure if any action is based on conscious desire for continued recovery or an unconscious wish to return to using. And that's where I was, like, you know, like in the beginning, it was like I felt like I was staying clean when it didn't make no sense to stay clean. You know, it's like I wanted to know by the second meeting, I wanted you guys to tell me how this story ends. You know, is it going to be worse? You know, what do I get? See, I'm an addict. I don't do nothing for nothing. What's the payoff? And maybe I could give this thing a shot. But that's the kind of the attitude I brought into this thing. But so, you know, at this point, I hadn't been introduced to NA, and I was in this treatment program, and they had a meeting that came in once a week, but it wasn't NA, and that was my first introduction to 12-step meetings, you know, and I went to it, and it was cool, and it was all right, but you know, I love, you know, that. That clarity statement that was read at the beginning of this. Hey, thank you all for bearing with me. I feel like I'm slowing down a little bit now. Everything's starting to come in here, okay? But you know, like I said, we have our own language here, and we have our own message, and it's a strong message, and a lot of us really believe strongly in it. But why I say that is, like, when they put me in this program, I call it geriatric recovery program. I mean, I didn't identify, you know, I was different from everybody else, and it was a small group. And they went around the room, you know, they had us introduce ourselves. And I'd never been in any of these meetings. And, you know, so-and-so alcoholic. And they got to me, and I just looked at the counselor, like, what do I do? What do I say? She said, cross-addicted. Yeah. And so, like, you know, that's how I came into meetings, and like I'd introduce myself like that, and everyone else was just addicts, except there was this one dude. Me and him became pretty good buddies. His name was Arnold. He'd say, my name is Arnold, and I have multiple addictions. And I'm thinking, dude, you ain't got a chance, you know. But you know, I didn't get this. It's one disease, one message, you know, for me. It works. But you know, So the way I got introduced to Narcotics Anonymous was in this program, and it's kind of cool, you know, that part of this convention is geared around basic text and putting them in jails and prisons and all. Well, that was part of my introduction. Like in this group, they were giving us this other literature, and then they had like a place where you'd sit down and do the groups, you know, where you like confront each other and shit, you know, that not like what we do here. And there was these blue books there that they weren't giving to anybody, but it was this stack of blue books, and I'd seen them up there, and the one counselor, she got one of the books, and she came to me and she kind of like singled me out. She said, you know, Alan, I think you should try Narcotics Anonymous, and I'll give you this book if you promise you'll read it. And like, I'm all about the F word, free. I'm like, yeah, I'll take it. Yeah, heck yeah. And I And I swear in my mind I knew I was lying. And damn, it turns out I couldn't even lie right. I ended up reading the book. But, you know, and she gave me a meeting list. And I went to my first meeting in Harrisonburg. It was a Tuesday night. It was a candlelight meeting. And I didn't know at the time that the main meeting room of church was having a function there. And so they had everybody, like, stuffed in a room smaller than this many people. Everybody just crammed in there. And I got there right at the last minute, and I'm like, man, this ain't for me. There ain't a chair. That's my reason to go. And somebody said, hey, man, there's a chair right here, brother. Come on and have a seat. You know, and that was my first meeting. And, like, I couldn't tell you, like, you know, I couldn't tell you what all was shared there. There was a feeling, but, you know, honestly, you guys scared me. Like, I came face to face with my disease and the possibility of recovery. You know, we talk about if you want what we have to offer and if you're willing to make the effort to get it. Because I wasn't sure, you know, still like that, what I read in that pamphlet, I wasn't sure where I was at on this thing, you know. But I did know this, that without a shadow of a doubt, if I was ready to get clean, I could get clean and stay clean here in Narcotics Anonymous. So what I did is, next couple of days, I went to them other meetings, man. Hell no, I was scared of this because I knew it. I knew if I hung around here and did this, that my using days were over. And, you know, and I came back to the meetings and started getting connected in the fellowship. You know, but I'll tell you, like, how do you ever repay what's given here, the lives we got in Narcotics Anonymous? You know, they talked about this, you know, this gift of desperation. You know, desperate addicts come in here, and we build these lives beyond our wildest dreams. But, like, I was at a meeting there, I don't know, it was in my first year, and, like, I don't know if anyone else, but, like, the novelty of this thing had wore off. I'd been coming to meetings, I knew you guys, you know, like, other people had known me, they hadn't heard my rap, you know, I've heard yours, it's like, you know, we're doing, you know, it's just not, wasn't as exciting as what it was in the beginning, you know? And I started, you know, getting that feeling, you know, that I'd stay clean as long as I could stay clean, you know. I'd stay clean longer than anyone even would expect me to in my mind, you know. And here's the cool thing, though, man. Thank God I'd been going to meetings and was connected to this fellowship, because I decided that, like, this thing was, I was at my limit. And so, but I had no one of them conversations with myself. I have a lot of them. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go to the meeting first, and then I'm going to go do what I want to do. And I had a plan, too, that, like, I'm going to just, like, if anyone asks how you're doing, I'm going to say I'm cool. Everything's good. I had a plan. That's how the evening was going to go. And I went to the meeting, and, you know, Narcotics Anonymous rooms are like one of the safest places I've ever found in my life so far. Like, you know, this is where I've learned how to, like, be vulnerable and like, try to get real. But, like, I didn't know how to do that in the beginning, and I didn't know how to ask for help. And so I went to that meeting, and a couple people asked me, how you doing? You doing okay? You know, first, yeah, man, it's all good. And I couldn't hold that front, man. And we had the meeting, and this particular meeting, I usually sat in a circle, and I got that Why Are We Here reading, and I went and sat in the furthest corner by myself. You know, I was crying out for help, man, but I didn't know how to ask for help. But something inside of me knew this was a safe place, you know, because I mean, why did I come here first before I went to use? You know? And we opened that meeting, and I read that Why Are We Here reading, and my voice cracked, and just, you know, it was all just coming down in that moment. And they opened the meeting and said, is anyone having a hard time feeling like using? I was like, yeah, man, I'm hanging on by a thread. I think this is it for me. And you know what people did? They just shared their experience, strength, and hope with me, and shared how they felt like that before, and they didn't have to use, and what they did, and that I wasn't alone. And I left that meeting, and I went home that night. I didn't go anywhere else. And I woke up the next morning, and I was still clean. And the world looked different. It didn't look as hopeless as it did in that that moment. You know, and sometimes for me, that window in here of like, it can be really small, man, between using and not using. And like, every time that I use what's available here in this fellowship, man, it works. You know, but I'll tell you something else that just kind of came to my mind. It happened to me though. Like, so I got involved in the fellowship. And like I said, you heard me, I'm from a small area. Like, the home group that I first got into was, we had four meetings a week, and there was one meeting that we did at this detox unit, but it was one home group that did all these meetings. And so, like, you get involved, man, you're like a big fish in a little pond. You know what I mean? That the dominant personality in a group can carry have a huge presence, I'll say that. And I didn't quite understand this unity thing and how to like work together for a while. Like, you know, I always thought, you know, the group conscience would just go out back, fist fight, arm wrestle or something. There's a winner or loser, and you go on. That's the kind of mentality I brought here. And so what happened was I got too big for myself in here, I guess you'd say. Or I had a service position. I was doing a lot in the group. And this one lady did something with some of our seventh tradition money that goes against our traditions. But it wasn't a capital crime that I made it out to be. I'll tell you all that. And see, here's what happened. See, I took ownership of stuff. I wasn't even at the meeting that night. I was working a 4 to 12 shift, and I knew the meeting ended at 9, so I was taking my lunch break at 9. I was going down to straighten this mess out. And it was like, you know, I didn't have any step work behind me. And I'll tell you, it was one of those turning points in my or crossroads, whatever you want to say, in my recovery. Because I went down there, and I mean, like, I was ready to take on the whole damn group. I was mad at her for doing this, and I was mad at the seasoned members that they didn't speak up and straighten this stuff out, so I had to fix it, you know? And it was a terrible scene. I'm ashamed to say I was part of that. But what happened, though, was, so here I had a little bit of time, and I was in these meetings, and then, man, that shame came in on me, you know? I couldn't show my face back here. I mean, if you saw what I did, man, it wasn't pretty, you know. And so then there I was, you know. I got pretty desperate again in recovery. I was still clean, but I didn't know, you know, it was like, what am I going to do now? You know, like, the one thing that's been working in my life, you know, they'll never let me back there, you know. And I wanted to apologize to that lady and everyone else there that witnessed all this stuff, and the people that I threatened and everything. So, I mean, people were scattering. And but I didn't really know how to do that kind of thing. You know, it felt foreign to me. And so, like, the first, I wanted to do that, but, like, the first, you know, I was like, sneaking in the meeting, sneaking out, man. You know, but I made my way back in. You know, took a little bit of work. But then, like, I got the opportunity to apologize to that one lady, and it was her and another lady that, like, really saved me and kept me here. You know, that and it was like the classic good cop, bad cop, I swear. Like, the one lady, she was so soft spoken and all, and she told me that, you know, my behavior was not acceptable at all. She forgave me and they wanted me here. And then the other lady, she was a little tougher. And I still wonder if she wasn't lying to me, but she told me, she said, Alan, we need you here. We want you to show these other guys that they can stay clean in Narcotics Anonymous. Because, see, you know, then I got clean in March of 2000. And even then, you know, this isn't like for our predecessors in the 80s and stuff that was just, you know, they were treading brand new ground. But we had a mixed message, and our felt, you know, basically, we were considered the JV squad in my area. If you wanted a real recovery, you went over there. We hadn't got this kind of fellowship. Like, somebody getting clean now, man, this is a strong fellowship. And it keeps getting stronger every time, you know, more members come in. But, you know, once I, you know, if you want to say got through that, got my feet back on the ground there, you know, I realized that, like, if I was gonna wanted to stay clean and have the life that we have here, that I maybe ought to try these steps. You know, I wasn't one of them guys that, like, wanted a step working guy at my second meeting. I wasn't, you know, I needed to come to meetings and not use, and that's my story. But here's what I found out, like, what I've told folks, like, that that's the 12 steps in NA is a treasure map, you know, like there, you know, I want to know, like, how this fellowship, how this story is going to end for me. What's the end game for Alan? Well, it's a secret, man. I got to stay clean to find out. And so, like, you know, that's what the step work is, man. It's just like, you know, you think about a treasure map. It don't take you to the treasure at the end. You know, the 12 steps are a treasure map to a spiritual awakening. That's how I look at it. Because, like, you know, how would I say this? It's like, you know, it's pieces. You go to step one, find out what's there. Work that step. You know, check, and, you know, I had to check out my powerlessness and start practicing that principle of honesty, getting that in my life, of really looking at that, because my life was unmanageable as heck, you know. And it just made me think about this, you know, in that first step, it talks about the reservations, you know, and for me, it was like level of drugs was my reservations. You know, I didn't get that one disease thing. Like, in other words, I told you, like, I'd gotten arrested. I got rid of all the narcotics in my house. And then, like, as I came here and was, like, doing this a little bit, I started, like, calling myself to question. You know, like, all right, you know, another one of them conversations with myself. If you're trying to stay clean, why you got that box of beer under the kitchen sink in there still? You know, I wasn't telling anybody about that, because I know you guys would say, man, that's not a good idea. I hadn't picked it up yet, but, like, why is it still there? And then the next thing was, well, and I got rid of it. And it was like, well, why you still got all that drug paraphernalia around the house if you're trying to stay clean? You know, I had to clean that out. And then finally it came down to my triple beam scales. It's like, why do you have those if you're trying to stay clean? That was kind of like my last reservation there. But the cool thing is, man, I remember throwing them in this dumpster and, like, walking away feeling so empowered, because I knew I'd cleaned house. Or, like, you know, our book talks about getting our house in order. I was starting to put something in order, you know, and it was really cool, you know. And why I say that, like, to me, that this the secrets that are here for each of us to discover through the step process is, like, you know, if someone would have told me when I walked in these doors and said, well, you know, 20 years from now, you're going to fall in love with the woman of your dreams, get married, you know, and you're going to get married, and she's going to love you and want to be with you for who you are, not because she's, like, one of your needy projects that you got to rescue, that you can have a mutual relationship. I'd have said, y'all were crazy, man. Never happened. Check this out. We eloped. I was 60 years old, and we eloped. Yeah. So cool. Let me tell you. And so, didn't tell anyone. Didn't even tell my sponsor. Okay? Now, just hold on a second. I know what everyone's thinking there, right? No, we were engaged, and he knew we were going to get married. We had talked about it. So, like, you know, if you picked up a key tag or two and already found the love of your life in here, like a lot of us do, ask your sponsor before you go get married. Just a suggestion. But the cool thing was, but see, that's the thing, you know, like, one of the things I love about this fellowship and sponsorship. So we were there, and, you know, Emma had to go get all gussied up for the wedding and all that, you know, and I was there at the house where I was finding stuff, and before she left, I asked for permission. I said, can I call Jeff, my sponsor? Can I call my sponsor? Because, like, I'm not going to have like the greatest day of my life and not include my sponsor. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And it turns out I wasn't able to get a hold of him, and so it happened how it happened. But I couldn't do that, you know. When I think about like the sponsorship piece, man, like all the things we go through, the breakups, the loss. We've traveled halfway around the world together. It's not all bad, but like I just could not do that for me, and not include him in that. but you know, and here's the other thing I think is kind of cool about the whole situation. But anyway, sorry, I'm getting a little. Let me get a drink of water. So we got married on this beach, you know, and it was just the two of us and a friend of hers that married us. And then, and I'll never forget when she like came out of those trees, you know, that like it was a magic moment. And then what we did afterwards, we went to this really cool restaurant. We were in Naples, Florida, and like they got like these the bright white lights on the palm trees. Some of y'all are from Florida. We don't have that stuff in the mountains in Virginia, I can tell you, you know. But what was cool was like, and so she had her gown. We went to this restaurant, and we owned the night. You know, we did that night. That's one of the only times I could say that in my life, probably. But we owned the night there. It was so cool. And you know, and what was cool about it too was like, I think it's in our symbol. It talks about how one of the last things to be lost is the stigma of being an addict. And it wasn't that feeling like we're down there and we'd go and people would cheer. And there wasn't this feeling like, well, if you knew who I was, you know, we were just there in that moment. And we got to do that. And I'm so grateful I got to experience that. But, you know, I think about, too, like some of the things like that's happened in this recovery piece that like, you know, that why the secrets that have been revealed to me, like, no one told me that, what did y'all say, 2016, when this one, 2016, that I would lose my mother and I would be able to have peace in the sadness. You know, no one told me that was going to happen, you know, but I got to experience that, you know, that when she passed, I had no regrets. There wasn't nothing left unsaid, you know, and what a gift, you know, to be able to do that. And I owe all that to N.A., you know, or you know, there's a lot of things that happened along the way, you know, that were these secrets that were revealed to me. Like no one told me at 10 years clean that I was going to lose a brother to a suicide. And like I was able to I learned in that experience I was able to survive my feelings. I used to never, without using, I used to think I never could do that. You talk about it, and that was a hard time, man. Like, that one rocked my foundation. You know, oh, gosh, I hadn't been looking at these. I'm sorry. Then you have to wave them at me. I get running my mouth. Sorry. But you know what? Okay, I am going to have to cut this short. Damn, I need, sorry. But, you know, one of the things that, when I think about that situation, that for me was that, the sponsorship thing we talk about in here, you know, someone who believes in me and wants to help me in my recovery. You know, see, my sponsor gives me all these like really wise things, man. Like when I went through a breakup, like he says to me, you know, you seem to be pretty clear on her part about things. Now, what about your part? Let's write that. Yeah, these real profound things, you know, or like. I remember one time he told me, he said, you tell me everything. And I'm on the other end of the phone swelling up, you know, like I'm going to get Super Sponsee Award. And then he said, eventually. And, you know, and yeah, I'm that dude, like, there's a question in the first step, like, have you ever done something and pretended like that's what you intended to happen? Yeah, I'm that dude. I'll tell you about it after I got it all worked out. But you know, I'll try to rush this. I'm sorry. You know, one of the other things that was a big deal in my recovery was like, you know, my first inventory was so much about my relationship with my dad, and I was going through a divorce. You know, we never had a good relationship, and I made amends to my dad. I got to do that, and I, you know, I told him about the money I'd stole, the gas I'd stole. We live in all this stuff there. You know, I'm willing to, and the disunity and stuff I brought to my family, and you know, and I'm willing to make it right. You know, how much is it? And he just told me, you know, he said, just keep doing what you're doing. You know, but I'm gonna share this real quick because this just happened here recently. And like, you know, you talk about a nice step. So here it wasn't long ago. I was sitting at my dad's house having coffee with him, and he told me about this one time that this one beating he gave me, and he used the term repent. You know, he's got his own program. He said, like, you know, I've repented over this many times. You know, he had regretted. He was making amends to me the best way he could, and you know, and you talk about like being on the other side of that, and. I got to experience that and tell him that I forgave him and that I loved him. And you know what else I told him? I said, keep doing what you're doing. And he didn't get it. But, hey, anyways, I'm sorry. I ran long here. I wasn't paying attention here. I'm going to shut this down. Thank you all for being here and letting me share. Thanks.
So the next speaker that we have is a gentleman from, I'm not sure where he's claiming his home group is, if it's Beaver County or Greene County these days, but I've known Tracy for a long time, very long time, so I'll be happy to hear his story today, and without anything further, I'm going to give you Tracy, who is celebrating his fourth anniversary.
Yes, sir.
I'm Tracy. I'm an addict. I'm going to put this up here. I'm going to stand behind here because I still like walls, dark rooms, and boundaries. And I like to lean. I don't even know where to start. First off, yes, today is my four-year clean date. I didn't realize it was... It's been a busy spring. I've done spiritual retreats and just doing a lot of recovery things, but I'm so grateful for this fellowship. And I guess, you know, I guess I'd like to share a little bit about, I was on the phone with my oldest daughter, who is sort of one of my spiritual advisors. The woman is an unbelievably spiritual person. And I feel like when I call her and ask her to pray with me, I'm pulling out the heavy armor. You know what I mean? And part of it is, and there's just so much here. I'm like a squirrel, so if I jump, or I'm a squirrel hunter, if I jump around, forgive me. But I was talking to her right before this and saying, pray for me. And every time she prays for me, I cry. And this is she's 46 years old now. When I got clean, she was 30, or she was 8, 38. She was 8 years old. She had a younger sister. My younger daughter was 5. That young woman, or that one of my best friends in the world, my daughter, has 6 years clean now. Mm-hmm. We've been battling back and forth over the years. We did our first intervention with her when she was 16 years old. So she struggled too. Like I said, I get emotional about all this. I'm a serenity keeper. I've been trying to sell the shit, trying to make some money today. But so if you see me flitting around, I'm a relatively upbeat type of person. But you know, right before
at these conventions, I am probably at the most peace and serenity that I feel. Narcotics Anonymous has been a place that, for the first time in my life, I felt normal. I feel a little bit like an outsider out in the world. Not so much anymore, but I always did. I remember telling people, you know, I wanted to move in with everybody when I first got clean and started getting the pink cloud and the giggles and the, you know, I told somebody I wanted to move, you know, get us all. And he said, we'd kill each other in 15 minutes. So, and today I understand that. An incident that happened, and these are the kinds of things that I look for in my life today. And right before this meeting, I'm walking to this meeting, and I don't think Alan will mind me sharing this, but it is my higher power. I'm from Pittsburgh, power. You've heard of car power, right? I'm walking this meeting, and I asked this couple, are you looking for the meeting? Because I'm a serenity keeper. That's my job. And they said, yes. And I said, follow me. And I started sort of ahead of them walking. And I turned around and I wanted to introduce myself. And I introduced myself to the young lady, Emma. I got new friends from Virginia. And that's the beauty of this program. But I introduced myself to Emma, and Alan came up and said, I got a special hug to give you from Steve E. Steve E is my stepson to my last marriage. And he's in Virginia. I actually was expecting him to come up because, but Alan said, Steve wanted to give me a special hug. Because I introduced him to these rooms. I don't know how much time Steve had now. Six, 7 years?
Six, yeah.
So, like I said, I'm quite emotional over that. Not necessarily, I mean, I love Steve. He texts me on his anniversary every year to thank me. And it's like, there's no better gift. You know what I mean? Because when you stick around that long, I mean, I'm not, you know, you could stick around for a month or a week and have the love that I have for this program. But just that's what this is about for me, is just loving people, you know what I mean? But I look for that stuff in my life. And, you know, I was praying hard. I don't like to get up and do this. I'm uncomfortable. Like I said, I like walls and dark rooms. I love candlelight meetings, you know, because you can't see my blushing. You can't see my tears. You can't see me trembling. You know, not that I do that stuff so much anymore, but I always felt you could see my fear. And that was the scarier than the fear itself, that you could see it. And I never wanted anybody to see that. Like I said, I got 4 years clean. Now I've had 6 years clean, and I've had 17 years clean. And God keeps giving me the gift of desperation. I mean, if you want more, you can get it. You know what I mean? I think back of, I got clean in 1985 originally, and I remember, you know, one of the desperate things is I have a tendency to run away, obviously we all do, and I would physically run away. I've done it until I got in these rooms quite a few times. But I remember packing when those two little girls were 8 and 5. I remember packing everything I owned and leaving. And I told them, I went to New Hampshire. I had somebody I knew in New Hampshire, and they had a loft, an attic that I could sleep in. And I slept on a 4-foot mat. Had one of them 2-drawer cardboard dressers that you buy at Walmart or somewhere at like 15 cents or something. But that was my life. And when I was up there, I have been trying to, through medicine, religion, and psychiatry, trying to figure out what's wrong, because I've always felt just like an alien on this planet. And I used to have self-help books. I was a self-help book junkie, trying to figure it out, you know. And I bought a book called The Ultimate Secrets to Total Self-Confidence. I thought that was, I didn't realize all the drugs that were destroying the self-esteem were causing a confidence issue there. So, but you know what the book said, and there's a lot of good stuff out in the world, and it all works. I'm not gonna say it doesn't work. The difference between us or this program is I have a long-term program. My dad was emotionally ill. We used to pick him at Western Psych in Pittsburgh, and on weekends, you know. And my dad got better through psychiatry, but towards the end of his life, he didn't have the maintenance program that we have. You know what I mean? That continuing reminder, I guess. But that book that I read said, get on your knees and pray to whatever. And I did that in New Hampshire. My parents came up to visit me, and I told them to bring my guns because I was going to hunt. And they came up to visit. I had parents that were very supportive. They never let up on me as far as using. But anyway, I was planning on killing myself. I just did not want to live anymore. I had destroyed so many lives and destroyed those 2 little girls. You know, when you go home and you tell them to make them feel better that you were moving to New Hampshire to work in a seashell factory, you know, making bracelets. That's what I told these 2 little kids, you know. And talk about just, I just was destroying their lives. And, you know, and here I go jumping around. I didn't have well, for one thing, that the mother of my children, I got married in 11th grade. I was, she got pregnant in like April before the end of my 11th grade year. We got married, and it was quite a big deal that I was the only one in my high school that had their own apartment, you know. I had a wife as a legal guardian, you know. It was a funky life. I don't know where I was going with that, but the bottom line is, till I was 25, I put that woman through hell. Like I said, I tried killing myself in 7th grade. But anyway, that's that. But I come into the rooms, I guess, wanting to get clean. I volunteered. And when I guess where I was going was, I didn't have like a crazy street run kind of a act of addiction at that point, you know. A lot of double life kind of, you know, people say, oh, you're so wonderful, you're taking these responsibilities on. But in reality, I was hiding a lot of stuff, you know. I lived a double life. And that even continued way into recovery. But anyway, I remember, you know, signing up for a rehab or asking for help. And they said, could you stay clean till Tuesday and you can come into a rehab? And I said, yes. And then I went to the bar with my ex-wife, who's also got clean. And while she drank, and I stayed clean for 3 days. But I remember them calling me, like, once you get into the system, I guess the rehab stuff, some people from, I guess the other fellowship called up and asked if I wanted to go to a meeting. And I wasn't expecting that. Meetings, you know, the denial that I had, well, I guess it's not denial, it's the uninformed, like it talks about in the basic text, about uninformed sources of what addiction is, you know. I was a garbage can user. I mean, you know, I was a garbage can. If it was available, free, or could get you high, I did it, you know. It really didn't matter. But did you flash any signs yet, Judy? Good, cool. Because I, you know, get out of it here. But I, like I said, I went into the rehab, and you know how I liked self-help books. When they showed me the NA basic text, and it's the Who is an Addict chapter, talked about our whole life and thinking. When I picked up a drug, it always, I don't know if anybody remembers the show Taxi. See how I do go squirrel hunting here. Taxi, when Jim Ignatowski, the dope fiend on the show, they show an episode where he took drugs for the first time. He was this preppy college guy with a letter jacket sweater on and stuff. Somebody gave him a brownie. You know, he was real prim and proper. Somebody gave him a brownie, took one bite, and went, you know, like he acted. And that was me. It's like as soon as I took that first one, as I increased my resume of drug use, it became my new love. You know what I mean? Even if I didn't like it, I used it. Like people say a bad acid trip, I don't even remember a good one. You know what I mean? But I kept taking it, you know? Huffing inhalants, you know, when you're in sixth and seventh grade, that's what's available, you know? We used to get 5 gallon buckets and have, you know, people have keg parties. We had bucket parties, you know, because we were too young, people wouldn't buy us. You know, it was hard to get people to buy us alcohol. It was hard to find, you know, weed, whatever. But, another thing is here I go scrolling again. I went through emotional problems as a child. I guess they would probably have me on Adderall and ADD drugs, and, you know. But in third grade, I was so, was disturbed. I was so disturbed as a child that the only way they could get me to stay in a classroom was to tranquilize me. And in third grade, that's what they did. They took me to a psychiatrist and it kept me sitting there. You know what I mean? So I remember though, as a third grader, saying, Mom, can I keep that little bottle of pills beside my bed? Because I already had the idea that if one worked, what would two do? You know, the addict brain was already kicked in. And so, you know, it didn't take a lot of years. I always thought I was born 10 years too early, you know, the wrong century or whatever, you know. But when I come into, when I read that basic text about who is an addict, it was the secret. I remember calling my sister because me and her used to smoke weed and read the Bible, you know, trying to figure out what's wrong with us. I called her up and I said, I know what's wrong with us. I know what's wrong with us. We're addicts. And she said, where are you at? And I said, rehab. She said, call me later. You know what I mean? So anyway, that sister ended up getting clean too, and now has, I don't know. All those people have 38, 39 years now, and I keep sort of going in and out, but I'm not going to say I keep going in and out. I have, I don't even want to say excuses, but the bottom line is, I was, and when it talks about gifts of desperation, I got clean in 85, October 26th, on February 5th of 85, on February 5th of 86, I had a gun ready to blow my brains out, and those two little girls that I love so much were next, in the next room, and I had been going to meetings November, December, January, for 4 or 5 months. I was going to meetings. I was terrified to not go to meetings, but I had not surrendered yet to this program. The surrender was just about going to meetings, which kept me alive. So anyway, that's the first day. I remember that date, February 5th of 1986, because that's the first time I picked up a phone and gave up another level of surrender. You know what I mean? And I guess, you know, as I look back at my life, I get to these levels of surrender, and then I live on that for a while. And then I do something to create some more chaos and craziness in my life, and I go, okay, now I got to give that up, you know? I always feel like, if apples were bad for you, I would have used my quota up, if that makes any sense. But anyway, and you know, the recovery thing, I was able to build careers. I got social acceptability. For 17 years, I was clean. I was able to build a career. I raised those kids. I had two more kids with the same lady, and helped raise those kids, and was the baseball coach and the softball coach and all that stuff. And but there was still something I hadn't surrendered, even to a deeper level. And through some personal stuff, like relationship stuff, I kept screwing around on marriages. I kept bottoming out with that type of stuff. I found myself at 6 years clean. I was thinking this week of all those gifts of desperation where I felt like I want to die. After 6 years clean, I actually was finishing college, I decided to go to college because that's what a lot of us did back then, you know. There was a lot of folks that were predecessors that were pursuing that, and I thought, once I learned that all this is about fear, that's why I don't do anything. I'm afraid of succeeding. I'm afraid of failing. But at 6 years clean, I got to a point. I was still going to my home group and. You know, being involved, like I said earlier about, I was a garbage can, the denial. I felt like you had to use one drug all the time. I was fighting denial all the time, like you weren't sick enough to be in these rooms. And so this is always funny to me, is I heard somebody say, the sickest people go to service meetings. So to prove to you guys that I'm sick, I started going to service meetings. That was part of, you know, well, for one thing, there was only 4 or 5 meetings a week. I'm from the Beaver Valley over here, a little bit northwest of here. But I started going to those meetings because they were another recovery meeting to me. I was so terrified, and this is what blows my mind, that I used again. I was so terrified of using that I did not listen to anything but spiritual or, you know, religious music. I didn't read anything but recovery stuff. I was terrified to quit thinking about recovery. And one of my favorite memories is those two little girls. Their mother ended up in rehab in a halfway house, and I was raising them by myself. And I remember one Saturday morning saying, they were watching the Smurfs, which is one of my all-time favorites. I sat down on the couch with these two little girls, and I forgot about recovery for a minute. I'm talking like I was obsessed with, if I quit thinking about recovery, I was going to use again. But I sat down and I watched the Smurfs, and I caught myself like forgetting about recovery for a minute. This is, I don't even, well, it was only eight or nine months clean. And I remember calling a guy and saying, I think I'm relapsing. I just watched the Smurfs. You know what I mean? I mean, that's how afraid I was of using again. I was terrified. And I guess the point of that is I did use again. So I don't take for granted today how well I'm doing, how much I want to stay clean. It's all there, it's all good, but I know I could lose it, you know? Like I said, I got at 6 years clean, I called up a rehab because I had people in the rooms that were therapists, and I actually went in, I called the rehab and talked to this guy, a personal friend, and said, do you think I could go in? Because I was ready to die again, clean, not using. And I said, could I go into the rehab? It was like the holiday season. I said, I need like a tune-up or something. I'm gonna run into a bridge abutment, you know, or I'm going to use. And they let me. And part of the process was I had destroyed that poor woman that has my children. 5 minutes? Okay, good. That's nice. That's good. Now my train of thoughts. Thanks, Judy. But anyway, I went into a halfway house then too at 6 months or 6 years clean. So I've learned, no matter what, don't give up. Don't quit asking for help. I used again in 2002, going to doctors. I had got away from these rooms. Some personal stuff, getting away from my area, my home family. I got away from it. I ended up going to doctors. In my career, I become a chemist, and then I become a pharmaceutical chemist. So that sort of chunk of time with going to doctors and making medicine for doctors, you know what I mean? It made for a funky, twisted lifestyle. And I got completely away from these rooms. And I did a lot of, it's not like I had free reign of chemicals, but being the creative addict that I am, the sneaky addict that I am, I was able to work my way around and supply myself to a certain extent. Let's put it this way, I supplemented what the doctor was giving me, you know. And in 2011, I got clean. I was taking, there was a drug that we were making that I was able to get big bags of the powder, the pure powder, and I thought, I'm going to lose all that social acceptability I had got, you know, houses and cars. Not that that stuff's a big deal. Actually, that stuff's empty today, you know. But anyway, I got clean again. I stayed clean for 6 years, and then I got a
a divorce from Steve's mom, and I had no adult responsibility. And my last reservation, I hope, was that I had that fantasy that I could sit on my back porch and smoke weed and enjoy the sunset drinking vodka. You know what I mean? If anybody has that reservation, it's a lonely, dark place. And like I said, I got clean, and that was only a, I don't want to say only, that was a year and a half sort of run. But I called a friend who's in the rooms, and I said, "Joe, I don't think I felt enough pain yet." And he said, "Joe's the kind of guy who'll say, come up here, I'll hit you in the head with a hammer, and you will feel pain." You know what I mean? So I started sharing and talking with, and you know, during that year and a half, and this is not something I'm proud of, but I did. I live in an area where there's 4 NA meetings. NA, even if I was using, I knew I had to go back there. I knew it. And I had 2 home groups. There's 4 meetings in the whole county, down in Greene County. And there's about maybe 8 people in NA down in that county. And 2 of the meetings we started, and I was opening those 2 meetings 1 minute. That's a good timing. 2 of those meetings I was opening that year and a half that I was using. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't abandon NA. You know what I mean? That's not altruistic in any way. I just didn't know what else to do. So I would go, not go high, but after the meeting, I was down getting beer or going home and smoking weed. I had cannabis connections, lots of them, you know, this legal shit that comes around the country. But anyway, it got to the point where I can't do this anymore. And I drove drunk for the first time since 1985. And I thought, all the shit that I have to lose. All 4 of my children today texted me, "Happy anniversary." You know what I mean? All fucking 4 of them. And I will finish with that. Peace out.
Okay, can we have the reading of We Do Recover?
Hey, I'm Robbie and I'm an addict.
Hey, Robbie.
We do recover. When at the end of the road we find that we can no longer function as a human being, either with or without drugs, we all face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? There seems to be this alternative. Either go on the best we can to the bitter ends, jails, institutions, or death, or find a new way to live. In years gone by, very few addicts ever had this last choice. Those who are addicted today are more fortunate. For the first time in man's entire history, a simple way has been proving itself in the lives of many addicts. It is available to us all. This is a simple, spiritual, not religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous.
Does somebody have the 3rd step statement?
Yeah, Jake, addict.
Hey, Jake.
The 3rd step statement. Take my will and my life, guide me in my recovery, show me how to live.
Thank you. I want to thank everybody for reading and your service, and Tracy and Alan, it was good to hear your message. It's really appreciated. And with nothing further, we're going to close the meeting with Serenity Prayer. I didn't have very good follow thing. So yeah, let's all try to get up in a circle.
Sure.
Hey!
Hey,
Alan, how'd you like to help us close the meeting?
Sure. Serenity prayers.
Yeah.
take a moment of silence for the still suffering addict, and we'll close with the we version of the serenity prayer. You brought us here.
God, grant us serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to tell the difference.
Come back and work.
Like me.